This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. Currently, because of COVID-19 and various restrictions, we are building this Saturday podcast out of the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors. This is what we got up to this week.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland.
I have been out every morning this week, very early in the morning, say about 5:30. And then, so you start walking in the dark, essentially, and carry on walking, and the light starts to grow in the sky, and then you get just that hint of colour in the sky, and there's a point where the sun actually breaks the horizon. And it makes me smile every single time. The skies have been beautiful this week. I'm Mark Stephen. With me once again, 40 miles to the north, Mr. Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on that. It's a beautiful, beautiful morning. There's a crescent moon still poking through the sunshine. Mars has just disappeared, but it was really, really red this morning. Orion's belt in the distance. Just an absolutely wonderful day to stay in bed.
I don't know what it is, but it seems to be that things have been getting busier again this week. I'm planning to try and walk the West Island Way in a couple of weeks because it's coming up to its 40th anniversary, which is why I've been going out walking in the mornings just to see if I could. More of that in coming weeks. And we were meant to visit the Bass Rock on Wednesday, but sadly the weather just scuppered the plan, although we are hoping to get out next week.
Yeah, we have high hopes. We'll be next Friday. A bit of a gentle wind here, but it's just a delightful morning. Yeah, we kind of have a slight feeling me back to work now. I've been out filming with Landward all week, and what a shock the driving was. Yeah. I was sitting in the car park that is the Edinburgh bypass and thinking, you know, is this what I want to do? But yeah, it's been great to get back.
Yeah. Now, at this stage, we planned, as if a man proposes, God disposes, to just stop and let you listen to the sound of the wind in the trees. But it's absolutely flat calm here at the moment. There isn't so much as a rustle on the trees, so we'll not bother with that. As you'll hear shortly, Mr. McElroy has been out and about, however, capturing pretty good wind noises, and we revisit an island with its fair share of gnomes.
It's a fantastic wee story. The mystery bird is still going strong. Here's your first chance. I know a lot of people are excited about this. No clues as yet, but have a listen to this. It's fantastic. Sounds like a lot of fat old gentlemen after an after-dinner speech tucking into the porch. What's your best guess?
Now, I'm trying to remember if it was last year or the year before Lost Words, fabulous book, came out by writer Robert McFarlane and the visual artist Jackie Morris. It sprang from the fact that common words from the natural world had actually been removed from children's dictionaries because they were falling out of common use. Things like conker or acorn or kingfisher. Now, off the back of that, there was a Lost Words project. The book was so successful, it led to this musical project called the Lost Words Spell Songs. And Scottish folk singer Corinne Pawart was one of the team.
That was such a beautiful project to be involved in. So Robert and Jackie are both big music fans, and They worked in collaboration with an organisation called Folk by the Oak, which is an English folk festival, to bring together 8 writers and musicians in a residency. This was at the beginning of last year. So they include folks that would be well known to a Scottish audience, Julie Fowlis, Chris Drever, but also the Senegalese kora player and composer Sekou Keita. 8 of us all together for a week. To respond to this book, The Lost Words includes 20 words that were falling out of use. In fact, they had been excised from one of the major children's dictionaries. That was what sparked the project, was just how can it be that words like, I mean, for me, heron and wren and willow, they're so familiar to me in this place. How can they be falling out of children's dictionaries? So we were given free rein by Jackie and Robert as the creators of that book to respond however we wanted to. And the project is called Spell Songs. And, oh, it's been an absolute delight to be involved in that project. It's one of the most genuinely collaborative. Yeah, I felt like I've joined a new band by accident. And I think some of the stuff that we've created is really very, very beautiful, and I think it's generated some of the kind of most heartfelt feedback from people that I've ever had for any project that I've been involved in.
This podcast isn't about us, but I'm going to reference myself for this, because I listened to your music this morning. You wrote a blessing for Lost Words. I've had, for the last 3 or 4 weeks, actually quite I'm up against a deadline, you know, and I'm trying to get something finished and I'm working hard on it, etc. And it's occupying damn near every moment of my day. And I listened to that piece of music and I suddenly found myself crying. And it was a release, pure and simple. And I felt so much better afterwards.
I cried as well when I would listen to it again yesterday.
Oh, no.
Because I've listened to that.
A pair of saps, we are.
I know. Well, it just shows our soft hearts.
That's your folk singer's job. That's it. If you've made somebody cry, you've done the job.
Yeah. But I've listened to the album a lot because I've played it a lot on BBC Radio Scotland's Travelling Folk. So I have heard it before, but for some reason it just struck me yesterday. It just, whew. I think it's the context of the world that we're living in at the moment as well. It seemed to take on new meaning.
Enter the wild with care, my love, and speak the things you see. Let new names take and root and thrive and grow. And even as you travel far from heather, crag and river, may you like the little fisher set the stream alight with glitter. May you enter now as otter without falter into water.
The way that The Lost Words is conceived is that the words in the book, which are written by Robert, are all written in the form of spells. So they're very dynamic and visual, and there's lots and lots of imagery. You can see lots of stuff. And when I was reading through all of these spells, I was reminded of one of my favourite folk collections is Carmina Gadelica, which is a Gaelic collection of spells, incantations, charms, and it's gorgeous. I mean, I don't understand the Gaelic, but the translations into English are absolutely beautiful. And what struck me was that loads of these charms and incantations and lullabies were rich with natural imagery. So I suggested to the group that we might write a blessing that brought in a number of Robert's different spells into one piece. In my head, with the Carmina Gadelica and Gaelic kind of incantation form.
And even as you journey on, past dying stars exploding, like the gilded one in flight, leave your little gifts of light. And in the dead of night, my darling, find the gleaming eye of starling, like the little lady sing your heart to all dark matter.
So it's sort of like a litany of the creatures that appear in the Lost Words. And because so many of us involved in the residency are parents, we were really in the mode of thinking about the impact of losing these words and what that means for the future of our own children. So it's effectively a blessing come lullaby for the generations to come.
Walk through the world with care, my love, and sing the things you see. Let new names take root and thrive. Swim you deeper, oh my little silver seeker, even as the hours.
That's just part of the Lost Words blessing from the Spell Songs collaboration, written by Corinne Polwart. And you can hear more of that conversation with Corinne on the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, available in the podcast section of the Out of Doors page of the BBC Radio website, or you can find it on BBC Sounds. I cannot remember, Ewan, that John Peel once played a track back-to-back three times on his evening programme because he said it was the most perfect pop song ever. We've been so impressed by that particular, you know, the Lost Words blessing. It's just a lovely piece of music.
It's a beautiful thing. I'd never heard it before, but I'm standing here and I've got headphones on, so you've got beautiful quality music. Gentle breeze blowing now through the trees. And you just kind of get immersed in the countryside and that music flowing over you. It's just... I wasn't quite crying, but it was certainly a tear in my eye. You know, here we are, BBC Radio Scotland, the programme that makes you greet.
Our archive piece this week comes from 2017, when we followed the source, or when we basically made our way right from the top down to the bottom of the River Forth. One of the highlights of the trip, and there were umpteen, was when we took a boat trip on the Maid of the Forth to the island of Inchcombe. Russell Moran of Historic Environment Scotland was our guide, but... on Inchcombe, he's got a posh title. He's referred to as the steward. So I said to him, OK, how many stewards are there on the island?
There is two stewards that live on the island. They live in the wee cottage at the back there. They stay 5 days a week and then they go off for 2 days. And then the relief stewards, like myself, come across and look after.
So is this a good gig?
I think it's a cracking gig. I also do places like Aberdare across the water and Dunfermline Abbey and Palace, but... there's not many places you can say you came by boat to come out here.
Yeah. Well, we're saying just as well, because you literally walk about 100 metres round towards the wee beach there, and it's an entirely different environment. All of a sudden, you know, you start speaking more quietly. It has that sort of slightly Treasure Island feel about it.
It is.
Well, yeah. There's also this strange... Is this wartime behind us? What's going on there?
Well, at the moment, we use that for our shop and our small museum. I think it might have been a naffy of some sort. I'm not sure, but it was. They are World War One and Two buildings. World War One and Two defences pepper the island.
Did you like sharing it with people, or do you quite like to have it on your own?
No, I very much like sharing it. The visitors are always curious about different aspects. There's always somebody that's interested about the Abbey, somebody that's interested about the World War One and Two stuff, or even the gnomes. One-inch gnome.
Well, that's coming up.
Yes, let's talk about the gnomes.
Yeah, well, describe it first of all. You've got this...
It's nuts. You know, it's an outcropping of rock. First time we went past it in a little boat, outcropping of rock, and someone has basically nailed garden gnomes all over it, or glued garden gnomes. I don't know how you attach garden gnomes.
Are you responsible for that?
We are not responsible for it, no. And we do not encourage it.
You can't stop it.
No. I spoke to somebody years ago who said it's the wardens on the island that each bring a gnome and they leave it when they leave the island.
Well, I know the wardens that I've been on with have not done that.
These are responsible wardens.
We are responsible wardens.
Well, what's the theory then? How do you think it happened?
It happens while we are shut. We're shut over the winter and they breed over the winter.
The gnome gorillas come down in patrol boats.
So we have no idea who's doing it.
So just coming round the corner of the Abbey is the 21st century, basically. Finlandia Seaways.
It's a busy seaway. There's lots of...
It's a ferry, obviously. Roll-on, roll-off ferry. You just see the ramp and then... Well, you see the back of it now.
Yeah. I suppose at Ram's home, this has always been a busy seaway.
Exactly,
presumably the island would be an important part of that.
I would have thought so. I mean, as stewards, we've wondered about it and we've wondered whether it would be a good stopping-off place from Iona going out down to Lindisfarne. There was close links because the canons here formed a priestly role as well. They weren't a exclusive monk trying to keep away from things. They served a lot of the parishes along the Fife coast and went across there. And there's very close ties to St. Fillan's across the water.
Come on, let's get the easy way up.
Easier. I didn't say it was easy.
No, I heard him say easy. I heard easy. There we go. We found a stairway inside the building itself. Which Russell is tripping up and we are trudging up. Okay.
This takes you halfway up the bell tower and then you...
Then it gets really stupid.
Then it gets really stupid, yes.
Yeah, that's it.
It's onwards and upwards if you want to go up to the top and get the views.
Yeah, well, yeah, all right, fine. Okay, it's this.
Oh, God, it's tiny.
All right. Here we go. This is so narrow and dark that I'm just making my way up. The steps are just big enough for my toes, essentially. And I've got my right arm jammed against the central pivot of the spiral staircase. Whew, dear me. That is tight. Oh! They had pigeons.
They had pigeons as well, yes.
We're in a ducat.
Halfway up the bell tower.
Deaf pigeons. Well, the view's getting better all the time.
Whew! You've got another level of glass.
Oh, for the love of goodness. It's quite unnecessarily tall, this bell tower.
That staircase is something else, isn't it?
Without a doubt, it is the tightest spiral staircase I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, these monks must have been thin guys. Yeah,
including the Vatican.
Wow. That's good.
Whew, look at that.
You get a good view of the three bridges now.
You've still got a good view of the three bridges. It's just out of focus, it's soft focus, it's misty. Yeah. It's really pretty. Ah, oh, me.
So, the bells hung from here, did they?
There would have been a level across here, I think, and they would have hung in there, yep, hung in that chamber bit there.
I said it before, I'll say it again. It feels completely different. Stone throw from Edinburgh. And it feels you could be, I don't know, somewhere in the Pacific, anywhere.
You are about, I would say, 2 linear miles away from the rail bridge. We're just looking at that Finlandia ferry we saw earlier, steaming up past. It doesn't look quite so incongruous as it does when it was going past the Abbey, and yet you could be forgiven for thinking, yeah, that over there, that's nowadays. Where we are, it's a different time period altogether.
It does. It does strike you as a different time period. And certainly when it's quiet like it is today.
This is quiet.
This is quiet. You just saw 100 people getting back onto that last boat. But that was the one boat. The rest of them have been fairly quiet today. But we do get a few people coming out saying, we're just looking for a piece of quiet. We're coming out here. Get away from the crowds. It's a good place to come.
See, that was Russell Moran, one of the stewards of Inchcombe. And we're pleased to say that the trips to Inchcombe on the May the 4th are back up and running. But check first, in light of new coronavirus restrictions, because they seem to be changing quite regularly. You will find a link on our webpage. I had forgotten about that ship sailing past. It was like a factory suddenly going past the end of your street. See, some folk are getting it right, but William Galashiels didn't. He says, Mystery Bird is an old man, Albert Ross. Albatross. Katie in Herefordshire says, it took me a while too. Katie in Herefordshire says, is the mystery bird a pelican? Karen in Shetland says, sounds like a mallee, a fulmer. It actually does sound like a fulmer, but it's not, Karen. Oliver in Edinburgh, not about the Mystery Bird, says, listening to you from Portobello in Edinburgh while getting ready to cycle the train in Inverness, to Inverness, then up to Garve, then cycle to Ullapool, just in time for the inclement weather. And it will be inclement weather, Oliver. Head to the Outer Hebrides for my 30th birthday next week and a cycle tour of the islands. I'm a long-time listener since before I lived in Edinburgh, and your show definitely influenced the relocation to this beautiful place. Thanks for everything you do. Well, thank you. I hope you have a lovely time and dry out eventually.
Well, yeah, a bit confusing with that raven in the background or a crow. It's confusing everybody. It's not that, so ignore that one. But if you have any ideas on what that bird is, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. I'll give you a clue. You're saying pelicans. All these birds so far are resident or visitors to Scotland.
Indeed. Yeah, but this one obviously is an ostrich. Coming up, I get into a canoe the first time in a long time. The first time in a long time, and in a fairly unusual location. And the ever popular Doors Open Day is still happening this year, but in a very different way. We were remarking on the wind at the start of the programme, absence thereof, because it's been a pretty windy week all in all. So much so that Mr. McElwraith decided to put this theory to the test.
I'm going to try an interesting wee experiment tonight. I remember reading that Thomas Hardy, and this is when I was a very young man, could tell what kind of tree he was standing beside with his eyes closed by the sound of the wind blowing through the leaves. So it's a bit blustery tonight. Way in the distance there's the sound of barley being dried. But apart from that, I'm going to try it and see what happens. So I'm beside a birch tree. There's a stiffish kind of wind blowing, but it's gusty. So here's the birch. Right, we're moving over now. Underneath a massive gin tree I planted years ago. See if there's any difference at all. There's the gin, the cherries have been stripped by the birds. And there's a definite change in tone. The leaves are much bigger, a bit more wind resistance, it's bending a bit more. No, I couldn't identify them, but there's a definite difference. I'm moving up a wee bit further. And I think this one's going to be quieter. This is a big weeping willow tree. It's waving about. It's almost like kelp in a storm. The whole tree is heaving backwards and forwards, and the long trailing fronds almost of the willow are just ebbing and flowing in the wind. It's a delight to watch. But it's a different sound again. I was a bit sceptical at first, I must admit, but I'm beginning to sense there's a difference. Now, this is a copper beech. Just going to get under it just now. It's right by the edge of the barley field. Oh, and immediately you can hear the rattling of the leaves. It's a sort of dry rustle. Medium-sized leaves, medium-sized resistance. It's kind of fighting the wind. It's not like the willow that's just bowing and going with the flow. This is standing up to the wind. Okay, this is a big sycamore. This is absolutely fascinating, but I'm going to go round to the beech trees. I've got a shelter belt of beech trees. Oh, I've got a lovely little bat just patrolling in front of it, up and down, scooping up the last of the midges. And this is quite odd because it's a shelter belt. There's a real no man's land of wind, you know, it's screaming up there. But there's nothing in this little bit. There's a good chance just to hear what the beach sounds like in the tranquility of this no man's land. Just moving a bit further into the edge. It's really bizarre. This pigeon just taking off in disgust. But it's a sense of tranquility. I never meant to doubt Thomas Hardy. But I did. But he's right. I mean, I certainly couldn't identify a tree with the sound of its leaves. But they're very, very different. There's a whole new world out there.
I think it's one of the hallmarks of the occasional, entirely accidental genius of this programme that you can manage to convince perfectly sane, perfectly intelligent people to listen to the sound of wind and leaves for 7 minutes to go, oh, that's right.
Yeah, this is proper grown-up radio. This isn't for amateur. I must admit, Mark, I was a wee bit not apprehensive.
Skeptical.
I wondered if it was too sceptical. Is it too subtle? And but there is a definite difference. It's a magical thing.
Yeah, without a doubt. I have to say, I mean, Thomas Hardy was such a strange man. His first wife died, he got remarried, as Victorian men did, and then got his wife to write, his second wife, to basically write out all the love poems that he wrote to his first wife. Slightly insensitive, I would have said. Yeah, but never mind. Andrew Wilson-Argall thinks the mystery bird is the eider duck. Afraid not.
Ooh.
And Hugh Burston, Hugh from Bear's Den, thinks it's the eider duck too. So neither of those is absolutely correct, or indeed even vaguely correct. Coming up, we'll be asking, what's the future for our outdoor education centres? I have to say, it's not looking terribly promising in a moment, and we've got a fascinating audio diary from Inverness. And what is Ewan's mystery bird this week? This is causing chaos. Friss and Newton Stewart says the bird is a green woodpecker. No, it's not, Friss. Jake and Bucky thinks the mystery bird is a storm petrel. Tell you,
Close there.
William Wallace, surely not, says, is it a ptarmigan? Anne and Ayer says, such beautiful tree leaf noises. Could it be on the school curriculum that young folk go out for a morning once a term? I think that's a very good idea. Pollinard says, good morning. Loving Ewan's piece about the wind and the willows. The art of tree identification from the rustle of leaves. All trees speak to us, although it's a bit difficult to hear them in the winter. I think they lose their tongues, I suppose, Pollinard. And this is from David Ross, Milton Keynes. Listeners all over. Said, good morning, gentlemen. Great show as always. Love spending Saturday morning listening to Out of Doors. I was wondering if you would be able to wish my dad, Donald Ross from Dingwall, a happy 75th birthday for tomorrow. He's an avid listener and has been for 30-plus years. This message comes from his son, David Ross, listening in Milton Keynes. Happy to do so. Happy birthday for that, David. Yeah. James says, just about to launch my kite and go kite surfing at Long Nidri and can see Inchcombe in the distance. I've asked Beth to listen in for her first time. Can you let her know it's a nice way to start the weekend? Well, of course it's a nice way to start the weekend. Lots of people think it's a nice way to start the weekend. You know, we've mentioned the Firth of Forth already this morning. Keen sea swimmer Kerry Flockhart has a view of the Forth from her home in Portobello. She's taken her fascination and love of this stretch of the water to quite considerable other level, as she's undertaking a 10-day walk and swim of the Firth of Forth coastline to raise awareness of the issues facing the marine environment. Our colleague Joanne McCauley met her earlier this week.
It's just after sunrise on Portobello Beach, and it's a lovely clear morning. The sun is up in the sky and there are a few yellow and pink clouds floating around, and we can see for miles along the coast and out over to Fife. Well, this is one of the stops along the route which Kerry Flockhart is taking. She's walking, swimming, litter picking along the way to chart what this coastline has to offer and to identify some of the challenges it's facing. Well, Kerry has just been in for her dawn dip in the sea before she heads off on the next leg of her adventure. So, Kerry, first of all, why are you charting the coastline in this way?
Well, during lockdown, I started litter picking quite regularly and swimming, and I noticed what was on the beach in Portobello, so I was kind of curious to see what it was like all around the rest of the Forth.
And what is it about this coastline that fascinates you so much?
It's right on my doorstep. I live here in Portobello, and I realise that I don't actually know it very well. I know Portobello, but I can see all this coastline from my beach that I swim at, but I don't know it. I've not really walked around a lot of it. I've been to parts of East Lothian, so I thought there's a lot out there to explore.
You've been on the go for a few nights now. How has it been so far, walking and swimming and taking in what's all around you?
Yeah, it's been pretty amazing. I started off at Dunbar, and so far I've swum with a couple of swim groups, one in Balhaven and also in Long Nidri. And the coastline's amazing. I've discovered beaches I didn't even know existed, and huge beaches as well.
And why are you undertaking the litter picking? Is that something that was concerning you when you started to do your sea swimming?
Yeah, because I was litter picking quite regularly, especially over lockdown. There was a lot of wet wipes in Portobello, and yeah, just a lot. I was picking up hundreds of them most days, actually. So I just thought, well, if this is a problem here, what is it like around the rest of the coast?
And what have you found with regards to the litter in different places along the coastline?
Probably near Dunbar and around North Berwick, there's quite a lot of fishing debris that seems to be washing up. There's a lot of fishing nets and fishermen's gloves. And so not so much of the wet wipes up there, but as soon as I kind of reach Gullen and around to Long Nidri, then things like wet wipes and all the cans become, there's a lot more of those there.
And as a sea swimmer, how does that concern you?
Well, when you're about to go swimming and you're picking up wet wipes and other sanitary items, it's not the most pleasant experience. So, yeah, you definitely become more aware of what's actually in the water once you start swimming.
And is this something you want to raise awareness of?
Yeah, absolutely. I think people just aren't aware. I think, you know, I was with friends yesterday and they couldn't even see all the wet wipes until I pointed them out. So that's one of the main problems that I see, at least. And they are just all tangled in the wet wipe, in the seaweed. So I think it's important for people just to know that it is a problem and that, you know, most of these have been flushed and that's why they're ending up there. So I just think it is a fact that people aren't aware that it's happening.
So, Kerry, as you move along the coastline, you're doing some seaweed surveys as well. What's that about?
Yeah, so that's the big seaweed search, and that's through the National History Museum. If you go onto their website, you can look at that. And it's to identify what seaweed is there and just take a note and record it.
And what can that tell us? How helpful would that be?
I think it kind of will give them, it's a citizen science project, so it'll give them an idea of what's growing where and probably, you know, the condition of the waters if certain seaweeds are growing there.
And what's special about this coastline for you as somebody who lives along this coastline?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've lived here for 16 years in Portobello and I've always enjoyed living by the sea, but probably since lockdown it's given me, you know, a lot more appreciation of what's on my doorstep. I've always thought I needed to go on an adventure up north or further afield, but actually we've got all this right here and it's amazing. And it's, you know, there's a lot of diversity along this coastline, even just walking from Dunbar to Portobello, you know, it changes all the time. So yeah, I think we're very lucky, but sometimes we just don't appreciate what's right there.
And you've met various people along the way who are invested in this coastline. Who have you been meeting so far?
Yeah, so far I've met a lot of swimmers and a lot of dog walkers. But yeah, just people who live along the coast as well. I've also met people who, you know, fish. There's all the people like the lobster fishermen up near North Berwick. So yeah, I think there are a lot of people making a living from the coastline and just a lot of people who are enjoying it for recreation as well.
So, Kerry, what do you want to achieve by your epic walk here?
Well, as well as walking and litter picking and swimming my way around the coast, I just hope to learn more about this amazing area on our doorstep. And also, I just would like to have the opportunity to speak to people who have their own connections to the Firth of Forth.
Kerry Flockhart talking to Joanne McCauley there. And if you would like to be involved in that between the 18th and 25th of September, the Marine Conservation Society are holding their Great British Beach Clean. And you'll find details on their website. And you can follow Kerry's journey on our Facebook page, and there's a link to that on our website. I think that's admirable, Ewan.
It is admirable, but it's a bit sad as well, especially with the wipes. And I think part of the problem is folk don't know that they're plastic. They think they're paper, and that they will break down very easily. They're all made of plastic, and it'll take hundreds, if not thousands, of years to break down.
Yeah.
And it just requires a bit of a change in our society, because, as she points out, that whole coastline, I was brought up along that North Berwick, Lonely Preston, Vans coastline, and it is outstanding. And when you think, warming to his theme, you and I have cycled that.
Yeah.
It's, what, 15 minutes out of Edinburgh, and you're in an absolutely idyllic landscape.
Yeah. As we pointed out before, as you cycle into Edinburgh, you hit the no conversation zone. You know, prior to that, we're going, morning, you know, and folk go, morning, back to you. You know, and you hit just Edinburgh, and you go, morning, and folk look into, why are you speaking to me? And then there's a point where you cycle out of Edinburgh, about Portobello, just the outskirts of Portobello, and you go, morning, and it works again. It's bizarre.
It is strange. I mean, obviously, we're alienating the whole capital city of Scotland in our broadcast this morning. Is it just a big city thing? It was very. You don't get the same thing in Glasgow. Folk chat to you.
Yeah. But there's also,
I don't know if you noticed, there's a time of day as well that people stop speaking to you.
Yes.
If you go for your walk at 5:30 in the morning, you're, hi, good morning. And right up to about 7:30, and then suddenly, people won't meet your eye and look away. Please don't speak to me. Please don't speak to me. Strange.
Yeah. Anyway, this comment from John in the French Pyrenees, down by the Spanish border. Thank you, as always, for the show, which is the highlight of my week. Brackets, lazy start, porridge and plenty of coffee after doing the horses and walking the dog. But I think for the first time I know what the mystery bird is. Is it a dirty camper at his morning ablutions? Actually, John, I don't know if dirty campers do morning ablutions. I think it's part of the problem. Best wishes to you both, he says. Keep up the great work, which is much appreciated. Like a lot of things at the moment, residential trips to Scotland's outdoor education centres are on hold. And because of that, the different organisations that run those facilities are saying, without financial help now, they may be forced to close forever. They've launched a campaign, Save Your Outdoor Centres. And to tell us more, we're joined by Martin Davidson, Scottish Director at the Outward Bound Trust. Martin, what do these centres do normally?
So normally we would host visits of young people, often coming with their schools, on a week's residential experience. And the purpose behind that is to help those young people develop their self-belief, their resilience, meeting their social and emotional needs, and help them discover themselves, really, so that they can have successful school careers and also make successful transitions into adulthood.
And who finances these, Martin? Are these state-run or are they all independently run?
So there's about 40 centres in total in Scotland, and the majority of those are run by third sector organisations, charitable organisations that run them really with the kind of mission of helping young people develop and helping with society. There are some that are run by local authorities, and there's in Scotland there's a small number of private commercial organisations that also run them. And I guess they're kind of funded through a real mix of funding. Parents will often make a contribution, but also schools often will use some of their funding, or local authorities might do that. And then particularly in the third sector, there's a lot of charitable trusts and other funders that will support the work of the organisations.
And you've been in lockdown since day one, presumably. You're just not running these courses anymore that many people listening to this programme will have benefited from when they were much younger.
Yeah, many thousands, millions of people will have benefited from them in Scotland. And indeed, the middle of March when lockdown commenced, the centres all closed their doors, for understandable reasons. And the real challenge that we're facing just now is the Scottish Government updated their advice to schools and local authorities about overnight school trips, residential experiences. They updated that advice in the middle of August, which effectively said that overnight school trips shouldn't happen all the way through to the end of the calendar year, so until Christmas at least. And so the centres will remain closed and will have been closed for 9 months of the year. And, thousands of young people will have been denied the opportunity to come to our centres this year as a result of those restrictions.
Life is changing in all sorts of areas of society. The restrictions are necessary, and I'm sure you understand that. But how much financial trouble are these outdoor centres in?
Outdoor centres fully understand, and I guess we're not really arguing against the restrictions. In terms of the financial difficulties, there are many centres that are in real crisis mode just now. We've already seen 5 centres close this year, 3 as a direct result of COVID restrictions and the lack of income as a result. But if you fast forward to the middle of next year, half of our centres will have closed. And the real cliffage for our organisations is at the end of October, when the furlough scheme, the job retention scheme, ends. Because many organisations, like across many sectors, have got their staff furloughed just now, and therefore have managed to reduce their costs considerably as a result. But come the 1st of November, then staff will be back on the books of those organisations with no income to pay for their salaries. And, it's not inconceivable that the restrictions for outdoor centres will continue beyond Christmas. And so we're facing a real crisis moment.
But you were also struggling as well, because a lot of councils were looking for cutbacks, and the outdoor centres were seen as the low-hanging fruit, and they were under serious financial pressure already.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, there isn't that many outdoor centres now that are left in local authority ownership and run, but there are some, and the two very public kind of cases at the beginning of the year with North Lanarkshire and Glasgow's centres. North Lanarkshire centre at Kilbowie has closed. Blairvaddick, Glasgow Council managed to find funding to keep their centre open. The experiences do cost money to run, and the centres, there's nobody making a lot of money out of running these centres or anything. The funding model for the organisations is kind of fragile, but all organisations, whether they're being run by local authorities or by charitable organisations, there's a huge amount of passion and energy because of the difference it can make to young people. We see week in, week out, young people just really changing as a result of their outdoor experiences. I mean, just this week I had an email from a gentleman who had come to Outward Bound in 1957, and he'd read one of the articles that was in the press this week about the campaign, and you know, his words were, "Outward Bound was the making of me, and I went on and had a successful military career, and I attribute that directly to the experience that I had in 1957 at Outward Bound." There's many people across the country that, you know, would talk about very passionately about their outdoor experience, their outdoor residential experience, and for often, for many, it would be the most memorable thing that they did at school.
There are undoubted benefits, Martin. I mean, I don't think anybody would question that, but, you know, this is a difficult situation. What do you want to happen?
So I guess what we're looking for is some support, some modest support from the Scottish Government. What we're looking for is that the Scottish Government can provide some financial support to help organisations through this very difficult time, you know, when they can't operate as they normally would. We're not looking for a handout or a bailout. What we are asking for government for is a bit of support to enable us to deploy our instructors into schools to help young people at this time on a non-residential basis. We know that there's interest and demand there for it, and indeed a few of our organisations have already started to do it on a small scale, on a tentative scale. But for us to do it on a larger scale, we need some financial support. It's a different funding model than a running a residential experience. And also the reality of the locations mean that we need to be really creative and flexible about the way that we go about doing it. Schools are telling us that young people need the types of experiences that we can provide right now as we come out of lockdown. You know, my own organisation is working with a small number of schools in Fort William, and the feedback from the teachers and the head teachers at the schools is so positive and is amazing, because the teachers telling us that the difference that the instructors are making in just helping those young people come back to school to re-engage with their friends and to build that resilience that they need at this time of in a very uncertain world is kind of critical. And we could do that on a much bigger scale with a bit of support from government at this time.
A bit of support and joined up thinking. I have no doubt that what you're saying makes perfect sense, because, you know, young people are finding this a very odd situation too. Martin, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning.
Thanks very much.
That was Martin Davidson there, Scotland Director at the Outward Bound Trust. If you have any thoughts on that, you can give us a call, 08085 929500 or text 80295. I mean, I remember clearly the experiences I had out and about at these things. Yeah. It does change your life, there's no question about it.
And you remember it all your life. I certainly went to one at Aberfoyle. Same with scout camps and things like that. That memory sticks with you for the rest of your life. And, well, a wee point I was thinking when Martin was talking, it's also providing employment in areas that aren't kind of crawling with jobs. Yeah. These outdoor centres are in quite often remote areas, and these jobs are an important part of a rural community. So I would certainly back everything he's saying. We need them, and let's keep them alive.
I like the idea. I mean, you know, if the young people can't go to these outdoor centres because of current regulations, put the instructors into the schools. That's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, it's genius.
Yeah. Anyway, mystery bird, Mike from Dalsurf. I've no idea what Dalsurf is. Do you know Dalsurf?
No, that's a new one on me.
New one too. Says he reckons it's a shell duck, which it isn't, sadly. Barry Sutherland, our South Yorkshire ornithological correspondent, is just whinging. He's saying, "I went to some marshlands for bird watching and came back covered in insect bites. Definitely wasn't midges, as the bites are now the size of quail eggs." And he would know. Are there any entomologists that have an idea of what the insects that bit me could have been? Barry, part of me wants to say send photographs, and then part of me really doesn't. Alf in Glasgow says, "Morning, lads. Is the mystery bird an eider duck?" Nope. Keith in Hertfordshire says, "Is it a Canada goose?" Nope. Mary Frame Gifford, "Is it a black-throated diver?" Nope. Loved listening to the tree spots, she says. And Alistair Ten says, "Is the mystery bird a gannet?" These are all good guesses, but they're kind of tiptoeing round about it. We're nearly there.
I tell you, Mark, I'm just looking up, and there's a whole flock of seagulls flying overhead. Uh-huh. Nothing special in that. But because they're so high, and the angle of the sun, it's catching the white, and that's all you can see. Yeah. And it's like a flock of diamonds just passing overhead.
That's
really spectacular.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a big flock of gulls in our top field the other day. And I walked up last night, and it's just... Why they've got any feathers at all, I don't know, because they seem to molt constantly. Anyway, there aren't many places in any city like the location of this next piece. It's strange. It's surrounded by offices and housing, and yet it's a place that for the last 50 years, very, very few people have been able to access. I went to visit it along with Mike Gifford from Adventure Aberdeen.
So this is Rubislaw Quarry. It's not been open to the public ever for water sports. First time the public have ever had the chance in about 50 or 60 years to even get in the site and see it. It's 140 metres deep in the deep end and 40 metres deep in the shallow end, and approximately 125 metres across. And it's full of beautiful fresh water.
See, that interesting. I was talking to my wife about this before I came here. And she went, "Ew, quarry." I said, "Look, it's just full of rainwater. Since 1969, it's been filling up with rainwater."
Yeah, it certainly has. There's no rivers or streams in. The water obviously escapes somewhere through natural cracks in the rocks. We had the water tested recently by an independent laboratory, and it's come back as perfect, basically. Yeah. So, yeah, we're really happy with the water quality in here.
Just to put 140 metres into context for those of you who grew up in Imperial, 10 metres is 33 feet, so 14 times 33 is 462 feet deep. That's deeper than most of the North Sea.
Yeah, it is exceptionally deep. Luckily for what we do, it doesn't make any difference, the depth. Yeah, whether you're in 30 centimetres of water or 120 metres, it makes no difference.
Come on, let's have a wee paddle about, because I mean, this is, it feels like a privilege, this, I must confess. You know, we came in off the road, you basically unlocked the gate, because security would be an issue here, I would imagine. You can't just have folk wandering about, but, you know, it is just surrounded by trees. You can hear the traffic, but it's like being in the country.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a little oasis right in the middle of the city, basically. As you say, security is very important to us, so the site's locked, all the equipment's locked up whilst we're not here. People can only come in when they've booked a space, and we've got activities running throughout the all weekends, throughout the October holidays and things, so yeah, it's basically booking by appointment, but yeah, it's a real privilege to be on here, and it's just great.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And how are you coping in terms of sort of COVID-19 restrictions?
So yeah, luckily for us, obviously being outdoors is kind of the perfect place to be. As you can see, it's a huge bit of water, so social distancing really isn't a problem. the canoes are very big as well, but we generally put the same households in the same canoes. We use PPE, we use hand sanitizer, and all the usual COVID guidelines we're following. We're following the Scottish Canoe Association guidelines as well about how we put our protocols in place. So yeah, it's all carefully thought through.
Yeah, it is perfectly safe to all intents and purposes. Now, needless to say, I am doing nothing here. Absolutely nothing, because it's impossible to paddle and record at the same time. That's my argument, and I'm sticking to it. There is what looks like a moorhen trying to take off in the water across there. So you just see these staccato sort of punches of water up behind it. There's a gull sitting on that old wire which comes down from the cliff. I think that used to be for actually raising stuff across. It was almost like an aerial crane. And the water itself, it looks dark, but it's quite inviting in a weird sort of way.
Yeah, it's absolutely lovely, actually. I was in there swimming last night. It's clear, it's clean.
You've got your own swimming pool.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's great. Hopefully it's an activity we will be offering soon, is open water swimming. Yeah, the water's actually quite warm. It's quite nice.
Actually, the water's not bad, is it?
It's not, actually, this time of year. The coldest time will be coming up over kind of January, February. Yeah. This time of year it's had all summer to warm up, similar to the sea activities we do. So this is the best time really to be swimming.
You are actually, however, trying to warm up an awful lot of water.
We certainly are, yeah, it would be. So luckily it's just the upper layer that'll ever warm up here. There's been technical divers in here before. I think it took them 7 to 8 hours to get down and back up with the decompression and everything. So yeah, the sunlight and warmth is never going to reach the bottom of here.
It is just otherworldly, as I said before, you know, and certainly at this time of year, the trees are just starting to change colour. So there's just one bright flash of yellow across there, probably on Sycamore or something.
but everything else is just changing hue. And of course, it's all reflected in this dark water. And as ever, in any form of canoeing, you get onto the water and all of a sudden your heart rate just goes down. It's just calming.
Yeah, it's an exceptionally relaxing way to spend some time, it really is. Again, as you say, just being this close to nature and all this greenery, you wouldn't know you're in the middle of the city here. There are sections on the River Dee, River Spey, right upstream near the Cairngorms that are just like this, really. Yeah, it's stunning.
One of the most striking, it's almost an architectural feature when you come down the bank, is these, well, they look like they are dead trees nowadays, but just kind of sticking out of the water.
Yeah, so when the water's obviously risen, it's come up onto where the original bank used to be, and there are little ledges on the quarry edge. So as you look down through the water here at the moment, you can see the trees, and they've got kind of lichens and mosses and things growing on them. They almost look like dead men's fingers when you go diving. They're ever so slightly eerie, but they're absolutely fascinating to see.
You know what it reminds me of? Mangrove swamp.
Yeah, I've never been to a mangrove swamp, but yeah, I'll take your word for
it. I've only been to one once.
Okay, yeah. That was brilliant. Yeah.
And the water is really clear. Yeah, you can see down comfortably, I would say, about 10 feet.
Yeah, easily. About, I think, 3 metres I was kind of jumping down to try and look at trees and other things the other day. Yeah. And it's absolutely clear down to that depth.
When you say jumping down to?
Well, I'm kind of jumping in and swimming around with a mask on to see what's under the water. Uh-huh. Obviously, it's part of just checking all our venues.
Of course,
good look inside. So we were in swimming around and just having a look around. So, yeah, great to explore.
Next time I come back here, and I will come back here, wetsuit, for definite, and mask, and snorkel.
Mike Gifford there from Adventure Aberdeen. If you fancy a go at that, canoeing in Rubislaw Quarry, there is a link on our website, but it has been extremely popular, so check the available dates on there. I've already suggested you that our next out-of-doors production planning meeting we actually do in Rubislaw Quarry in canoes. I can't see anything going wrong with that.
What could possibly go wrong? But it's a real gentle theme to the programme at the moment. It's kind of, it's not as in your face as it can be sometimes. Yeah. But one thing I was going to put, just explain what the quarry is, because there's a lot of folk out there who won't actually know what it is.
It was once the biggest man-made hole in Europe. It is where all the granite came out of that built Union Street and King Street and George Street and things like that. It was an absolutely enormous site. They stopped working, I think, in 1969. And because it's just a big hole in the ground, it is filled up in the last 50 years with rainwater to the top now, and it drains out at the top surface. But it's just huge. I mean, seriously, it's nearly 500 feet deep. So, interesting.
And it's such a resource, as you were pointing out, right in Aberdeen. It's been something that's been crying out to have something done with it for decades, and it's great to see it being used.
Yeah. It was bought by two local men, Mr. Black and Mr. White, and, you know, about 3 years ago, about 3 or 4 years ago, I met them, you know, and I phoned the researcher up and said, really? Mr. Black, Mr. White, you know, this isn't somebody taking the mickey, but no, it's absolutely genuine. We always ask for folk listen to this stuff. You can email us and tell us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Tim Mewshaw from Maryland did. He says, hello, folks. I wanted to comment on your recent episodes. Recent being a relative term. I'm pretty far behind in my podcast listening, so I'm only up to early August with your episodes, but I wanted to share that I'm really enjoying having the full out-of-doors episodes available. That's good. The only real difference I've noticed between them and the condensed version is the mystery bird contest. I can't participate, but it's fun listening to others do so. When everything's over, I kind of hope you stick to that format.
Yeah, I live in the States, and it's been a few years since I've visited Scotland, but once your country allows folk from my country to come in without going into quarantine, I'll be planning a visit as soon as I can. Keep up the good work, and cheers.
The mystery bird, David in Kintel says, is it a grey-legged goose? Nope. Robert Hind in Glasgow, bittern? Nope. Colm Scriven says, lovely to hear your dulcet voices in my ear this morning. I was just about to say that your mystery bird was Ewan doing his impersonation of an Eider duck, but since you said it wasn't an Eider, could it be Ewan doing a great northern diver? No, he doesn't do requests. I'm sorry. this is interesting. He says, I love how since lockdown has restricted your movements, your articles have become closer to home, like listening to the sounds of trees. Keep up the good work. That's an interesting observation.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah. And Linda on the Isle of Bute thinks it's a gannet. And Beth says, met your coast walker, Kerry, yesterday at Kinghorn and Fife. Very nice, interesting person, doing a great job of litter picking here with her two friends. And says, is the bird noise someone going for a sea swim? No, that's much, much higher pitched than that. Do you want to hear the noise again? I've spoken to several people over the last, I would say, month about our experiences of the initial stages of lockdown back in March and about how quiet it was. I mean, that was the real defining factor. It was just really, really quiet. And the noise of life has just kind of ramped up since. Wendy McCready is a sound engineer, works for the BBC in Inverness. She's captured the sounds of lockdown over a series of weeks and has assembled this soundscape for us.
It's quiet in lockdown. Other sound recordists keep talking about how different the soundscape in other cities are. The lack of traffic, the absence of planes, the empty streets. So many birds they'd never heard before. It wasn't like that here in Inverness. It was quiet, certainly, but not like that. It was Sunday evening quiet. Our office sits beside a busy junction and it was much, much quieter. But there were still cars. You could walk down the pedestrianised high street and instead of weaving through hordes of tourists, you passed a couple of cyclists and a forlorn-looking homeless bloke. For weeks, months, it felt like perpetual Sunday, as though the town had a lingering collective hangover from a Saturday night we'd never really got to enjoy. The only way to cope was to focus on the small pleasures. Having time to cook. Video calls with old friends. To do my Gaelic practice. And taking long walks. Of course, the unexpected joys of post. Who knew that would be important in these troubled times? The river and the canal have been my companions and my consolation. All was changing, yet fundamentally unchanged by these strange times. Many of these recordings were made on the Ness Islands. The last time I was there before lockdown, they were half underwater after a storm, and I nearly ended up in the river. It was barely a second or two of wobbly fear before the friends I was with grabbed a flailing arm each and ensured it was merely a mildly embarrassing anecdote. But that in itself is its own absence. That casual intimacy of grabbed arms and post-adrenaline laughter. The shared lunch in a busy cafe that preceded it. As lockdown eased, walking by the river with a friend rather than alone became a treat. Sitting on opposite ends of park benches, drinking takeaway coffee, an event worthy of note. That feeling that the whole world had stopped, except, or maybe especially, for those who were key workers and hadn't, and then restarted. Too soon? Too late? We're still stuck somewhere in between. Rushing back to normality, you'd be forgiven for thinking nothing has changed. But if you listen carefully, you might just hear what I hear. The world has changed, and it's still changing.
Wendy McCready up there in Inverness, and it's basically what Colin Skirlin was saying, that, you know, we're concentrating closer to home and the colour and the interest that is just in normal people's lives. Over the past, 20 years or so, this programme Out of Doors has visited quite a few of the places across Scotland that have taken part in the annual Doors Open Day events, places like the Fraser Wine Tower or the Aberdeen Marine Lab. Just a couple of spring to mind that I've done. This year, having crowds of folk visiting buildings is really pretty well a no-go for obvious reasons, but don't despair because they're still carrying on, albeit virtually. Joining us now to tell us more is Nicola Godsell from the Scottish Civic Trust that organises these events. How are you going to be doing it then, Nicola?
Hi. Like you say, we're not really encouraging people to go to venues, so instead we've taken things online and we're delivering a digital festival instead. So people can visit the website, doorsopendays.org.uk, and find venues and resources and activities and events to take part in from the comfort of their own home, I guess. And we've asked venues to come up with all sorts of different things. So there are live Q&As, there are webinars, there are guided tours, there are videos. There's a quiz tonight in Angus from the Heritage Museum. So there's all sorts of kind of different presentations from people of how you can take part.
So all the venues have been pretty keen to get involved in this?
Yeah. Yeah, we've had a brilliant uptake. You know, at the start of lockdown, when we realised that actually this is not going to be possible, and we thought, okay, this is our chance to try and go digital. and we could only do that by asking people, do you want to do this? So it was a real opportunity, I think, for a lot of venues to kind of step up, and it's been brilliant. There's been a lot of upskilling of venues, it has to be said, especially because so many people have been furloughed or venues have been shut. So the accessibility is a real issue for a lot of people. So this is a way that people can either share certain aspects of their programmes, or just remind people, look, we're still here, this is what happens if you do come and visit us.
I don't want to lure you into the trap of favouritism here, Nicola, but give me some highlights. I mean, you know, what kind of things are there around the country that folk would find really fascinating?
Well, I have to say that, you're right, it is really hard to pick. And certainly this weekend we have a certain number of regions taking part. So each weekend is different region takes part, a different number of regions take part, which is how we're keeping the flow across the month happening. So I've just been watching actually Arbroath Abbey Young People's Tour, which is brilliant. So you know, it's a tour of the Abbey, but from a very different point of view. So Angus and Aberdeen today, there's a tenements talk, which I'm quite interested in, between 4 and 5. So again, you go onto the website and you get a ticket and it's all free, and you join the Zoom event. And certainly Midlothian, which is also this weekend, they've just released a video tour from a former miner taking you around the National Mining Museum. Glasgow is next week, and they've got a range of films that they've just created as well, which is lovely. That takes you into some of the spaces that you wouldn't be able to go into, whether they were open or not.
I suppose one of the real advantages of this... Sorry, beg you. On you go, Ewan, on you go.
No, I was just going to say, one of them that kind of struck my eye was the Finiston Crane. That must be brilliant.
Oh, yes. Now, there has been a film made of that, yes. So you will be able to get right inside there, as if you were there.
I think one of the great things about this is you can visit umpteen locations in one day. Nicola, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
There's a link to the Doors Open Day website on ours, where you can find all the information for the different places taking part. I think it's a wonderful idea at the best of times, but I think just keeping it open, giving us that access in a different way is very commendable. Time now on this programme to reveal our mystery birds. And to say I've got a bumper crop of answers is a mild understatement. I'll just tell you just now, the correct answer was puffin. Doug and Olness got it, Willie and Breakin, Sandy Main and Blair Gowrie, Katie Perth, Paul Hamilton, although he thought it was either a puffin or a chainsaw, there's always one. Mary Toohey and Broughty Ferry said, is it puffins this week? Don't forget to mention the Shetland name Tammy Norrie, which is just lovely. Listening from under my duvet, get up, you lazy limmer, honestly. Keith Sutherland and Blair Gowrie says puffin, Dougie Dougie in Glenrothes. Barry Sutherland has got over his insect bites and says, a puffin or some form of seabird. That's what I like, precision. Mary McIntyre, a puffin. Janet McDonald, Tober Morey. Margaret Stewart, Dumfries and Calloway. Ian in Edinburgh. Lucy Inverness. Lackey and Troon. Alison McEachin. Katrina Gavin. You name it. Ian in the Isle of Bute. So tons of correct answers there, Ewan.
Yeah, and if anybody knows why it's called a Tammy Norrie, I'd be really grateful. I couldn't find the answer to that. But here's a puffin. In June 1840, three sailors from St Kilda landed on the craggy ledges of a nearby sea stack, Stackenarman. As they climbed up the rock, they spotted a peculiar bird that stood head and shoulders above the puffins and gulls and other seabirds. Just under 3 feet tall, with awkward, small wings that rendered it flightless, and a hooked beak that was almost as large as its head, its black and white plumage had earned it the title the original penguin. The sailors watched as the bird, a great auk, waddled clumsily along. Agile in the water, the unusual creature was defenceless against humans on land. Perhaps they enjoyed the thrill of the hunt, or perhaps they realised its meat and its feathers were incredibly valuable. In any case, they abducted the bird, tied its legs together and took it back to the ship. For 3 days, the sailors kept the great auk alive, but on the fourth, during a terrible storm, the sailors grew fearful and superstitious, condemning it as a maelstrom-conjuring witch. They stoned it to death. It was the last of its kind ever to be seen in the British Isles. A sad tale, but the auk lives on in the form of a close cousin, the world's most loved bird, the puffin. A magical bird, a bird like no other. Small, black and white birds with a sober,
comical expression, an expression like that of a priest or a monk pacing with their hands behind their backs. The Irish revered the puffin and wouldn't eat them. It was believed to be a sacred bird that the reincarnated souls of monks dwelt in them. In fact, the Atlantic puffin's Latin name, Fratella Cula Artica, translates into Little Brother of the North, which alludes to the bird's plumage resembling that of a friar's robe. But it's the beak that causes delight to all of those lucky enough to witness the penguin of the North in action. They throw themselves off the cliff, wings beating at 400 times a minute on the eternal hunt for fish. The hungry young demand a meal up to 100 times a day. And that's a lot of sand eels and young herring. Puffins can grab around 10 small fish in their beaks per dive. And that ability is thanks to the specialised tongue and the upper palate. The puffin's tongue ends in a core section that can hold onto the fish and simultaneously push it against a spiky patch in the bird's mouth where the prey stays put as the puffin continues hunting. One puffin in Britain set a record for carrying 62 fish in its beak at one time. Now, puffins' beaks are well known for that technicolour riot of black and red and orange. But just before winter, the birds shed the outer layer of their bills, leaving them smaller and duller. But when spring arrives, the beaks return to their bright form just in time for the mating season. Now, according to Icelandic folklore, the puffin can predict stormy weather. They'll come back to land 2 or 3 days before a gale. In Inuit culture, some tribes collect puffin bills and create a musical instrument called a shaker that had magical powers to heal the sick. Now, I said at the start, everyone loves a puffin. But it's not all good news for the birds because they are still hunted for eggs, feathers and meat. And the Atlantic puffin forms part of the national diet in Iceland, where the species doesn't have legal protection. Puffins are hunted by a technique called sky fishing, which involves catching the birds in a large net as they dive to the sea. And it's meat commonly featured on hotel menus. The fresh heart of a puffin is eaten raw as a traditional Icelandic delicacy. They tend to have a bit of a fishy taste, unsurprisingly, due to the enormous consumption of herring. Now, here's a top tip. They need to be put in milk overnight before cooking or marinating to take away at least some of that fishy taste. But finally, and a bit more palatable, this delightful bird has found its way into Scottish dance in the form of the Reel of the Puffins, created by John Bowie Dixon for a wedding in August 1998. The couple met each other in the Faroes while dancing with the Dunedin dancers and, of course, puffin watching. What a bird.
The glorious puffin, and the piece of music you heard there was the Black Bear, the tune played for the dance, the Reel of the Puffins. They're just wonderful creatures. They look like clockwork toys.
Yeah, they're fantastic, and I defy anybody to see a puffin as you did on the Isle of May and manage to film some of it and not have a smile on their face. It is terrific.
Yeah, although you've got to be reasonably brave to stick your hand down a puffin hole. And those beaks are sharp, there's no question of it. Anyway, that's all we've got time for in this week. Join us in the middle of the week when we've got another Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is coming this time from sound recorders David De La Haye, who's recorded some fascinating underwater sounds round about the Hebrides. But from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, myself, Mark Stephen, him, you and McElraith, thanks for listening.
deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.